Welcome to Great Minds, the podcast that looks beyond the glass at the culture, the history, the business, and the art of wine. I'm Gina Birch.
And I'm Julie Glenn. Today, we're so happy to have in studio with us Joelle Fisher, who founded Fisher Vineyards with her husband Fred in 1973. Fisher Vineyards is a Sonoma County winery which produces wine from both Napa and Sonoma vineyards, mainly Cabernet, Chardonnay, Cab Franc, and Syrah.
Good to see you, Joelle.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, you come to Southwest Florida quite a bit. We've seen you a couple times a year. I was just kind of curious, what is your connection to this area, and what is it that keeps bringing you back here?
The people.
Yeah, right.
How about the weather?
The weather, of course.
And the amazing wine accounts and restaurants that you get to see. And The joke has always been, I come a lot, but I've never put my feet in the sand.
We have to change that this visit.
That's what I keep saying.
Yeah.
And Ellie and I have kept talking about, let's do a wine tasting on the beach.
Yeah, Ellie is your representative from the distribution company.
Right. She represents our wines here in South Florida.
What do you think about the South Florida market, though? You talk about there are so many great wine people and wine things. We have a lot of small independent wine shops. I feel like we have more than the average.
Yes, but primarily most of our wines are sold on premise, and I come because it's our number one market. Florida is our number one market.
I was going to ask where else you go to a lot. Where else are the Fisher wines found?
Texas. So Florida and Texas compete side by side, and it's always kind of each year trying to see who's going to beat out. But I would say the two largest, and Florida usually the biggest. But I think because I've been coming the most and because the team that represents our wines here has just been remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for the last 20 years, they've become friends of ours. We actually hired one of their number one people to be our sales director at the winery.
I'm sure they appreciated that.
Well, she's still working with her friends here. She lives here. And she just represents us really well. Michigan is another big market for us, primarily because of my husband's family, the Fisher family from Detroit. And so that draws me here. I mean, I love coming.
So if you're listening to this podcast and you're in other states, they might just have to go to the website or be a part of your wine club to get the wines that we're going to be talking about.
Yes. I mean, we're available in many, many other states. Mm-hmm. I think we sell to probably 25 states.
Oh, that's good.
So they're available. There's a great availability, but the biggest, sales are here.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask, you talked about the draw to Detroit because of your husband's roots there. But your winery was founded in 1973, and that was kind of an exciting time for Napa. But it was still 3 years before the Judgment of Paris, which some argue helped put Napa and California wines on the map. So I'm wondering, what made you want to strike out west?
Well, my husband and I both lived in San Francisco, and we were in the big corporate world. And we basically, on our honeymoon, decided we wanted to do something together. We loved wine, and Napa and Sonoma were there. We'd go up on the weekends, although there were very few wineries at the time. And I always wanted to get out and have a big garden and be outside. It just drew us there, and we knew we wanted to have, if we did vineyards, we wanted them in the mountains or on a slope, and we struck out.
Well, talk about a big garden.
I know. I'm like, how many acres is that garden now?
We got a big garden, and our vineyards are approximately 65 to 70 acres, and I have a big vegetable garden and orchard and flowers, maybe 500 roses, so I have a lot to deal with.
I have kind of California envy when I hear about the fruit trees and the growing conditions there. They're just fantastic.
There are a lot of people that envy it, and when they come and see it, they say, this is what I've always wanted to do. What they fail to realize is the work involved. We are agricultural in every sense of the word, and what they don't see is when they're not there, we're out in the garden and in the vineyards working.
Up to your elbows in dirt, elbows and knees in dirt, it is definitely a lot of work.
How has it changed since you first started back in the early 70s? I mean, the whole industry, the area, I mean, That's a big question. I know you can just pick any part of it.
It's a big question. Yeah. And I will say every place I've been going over the years has changed. But one thing for sure, I'll tell you how it changed. There weren't any restaurants then. So when we wanted to go out to dinner, we went to San Francisco. Wow. And we took our dry cleaning to San Francisco. So, I mean, now look at it. Everybody comes there to want to eat and participate in the amazing cuisines and restaurants that we have. But back then, there was really nothing. It was blue-collar, agricultural, many of the old Italian farmers there. They were great cooks. They didn't go to restaurants.
They don't need a restaurant, really. Yeah.
No.
My grandparents moved up to Napa about the same time, and they didn't ever go out to eat. That's why going out to eat to my dad is still somewhat foreign. I mean, he goes, obviously,
right,
but
right.
He just doesn't. It's not a habit for him.
No, especially it was a tradition for them. I mean, they were great chefs, cooks, as they called them back then. I think the remarkable thing in this industry is how so much has evolved and it's matured. And for many, many years, people didn't really feel confident enough to evaluate about a wine. And now I see people have their own opinions, which is so great. They don't have to listen to other people tell them about a wine. You know, they get to taste it and see if they like it.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about how the business has evolved. I mean, with consolidation and things like that, are you watching that from where you are and the whole evolution of the wine industry? Because it seems like recently a lot of things have been gobbled up by big players.
Exactly. We watch it. I mean, we're living it. So, yes, we are now our second generation. Our three children are running the winery, which is we're just blessed with. But many of those who started early with us and didn't have children that wanted to participate had to end up selling as they got to be our age. So I do see that a lot. It's evolved in so many ways. There are so many different ways to make wine now. I mean, it used to be you needed your own vineyard and you'd make your own wine. Now you can buy juice. You can buy grapes. It's just different.
Yeah, I think when I was out selling wine before, there was a big misperception that there's this bucolic scene, and if you buy a wine from a winery, it's from vineyards that they own and tend to the grapes meticulously and very carefully choose right. when to harvest and things like that. That's really not the case.
Less and less is that the case.
It is the case in some
yes,
places.
Yes, it's still there.
But it's becoming rarer and rarer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a little bit to now that you're, you know, your kids are kind of running the vineyard and you've handed the torch over. You're still out. You're the face of the winery, and you know you come out. Obviously, you've flown cross country to be here with us today, just to be with us. I know
it was really
wasn't
nice.
For other reasons.
It was really
so
nice.
So thank you for that. But you know, on these trips that you've done over the years, they have what it's called the ride along, where you ride along with the rep
with
from
the sales
distribution
rep.
Company, and you ride to different accounts. And I'm just curious. I'm sure with all of the places you've been and the people you've ridden with, you've got to have some fun stories about some of those.
Well, I have some great stories, and I can give you one. But a number of years ago, after our kids came, and I made the proclamation that I was no longer going to do ride-arounds, that when I went into town, I would host a lunch. We would have the best buyers in town come to lunch, and they could drive to me, and we would have a lunch. Our wines are made to be served with food. And on a ride along, you just take a bottle and stop at a store or something. They stand at this cash register and they sip wine. Generally, it used to be in the old days out of plastic cups. And I just said, you know, that's an insult to our wine, and I'm not going to do that any longer.
Good for you. Yeah.
We
would often try and bring our own glasses to say, you know, let's taste it out of a wine glass, because I think it does make a big difference.
I've heard it described as one of the strangest first dates ever. It's a business first date. You know, you don't know whose car you're getting into. Have you ever gotten into a car with a sales rep that's the whole floor and seats are covered in Red Bull cans or any of those kinds of things?
No, but I'll tell you a really cute story because our daughter, our youngest daughter, does a lot of the marketing for me. And she was to meet one of her sales reps one morning after she had flown into town, came down from, out of the hotel room to meet her rep, and she couldn't remember his name. And so when she went out the front door, she saw a car there right in front of the door and a guy on his cell phone, you know, and she goes, that's typically what they look like. So she just opened the door, sat down and looked at him and said, are you my guy? And he just looked at her like, who are you? And she goes, oh, I'm sorry. I'm just usually used to getting into cars with people I don't know.
It's like my job, you know.
Yeah, that's my job.
Yeah. And it's all legal.
And it's all legal,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, oh, man.
But yes, often we don't know the people, but you, after riding with them for a day, you certainly do get to know them.
Right. And then people come to you all the time. Now, I've been to your Spring Mountain Winery, and that is not easy to get to.
No.
There's a lot of curvy roads, and I'm glad I was driving because I think I would have been on the floorboard.
Right.
But what a beautiful property you have. I mean, just the views, the wine. I tasted wine with one of your daughters, and we sat up on the mountain, and it was just – what a wonderful experience.
It is. I know people come, and they I think that having walked through the vineyards and up the steep hill and fallen often –
I was going to say and fall.
And fallen often because it's so steep. I think they go home and tasting the wines, that memory is in their – stuck in their head. It says something about it. It helps mm-hmm. you understand what differentiates one wine from another. Why there is a difference in different wines.
And the way those mountains create those microclimates is
exactly.
just incredible.
Exactly.
You can be so close and have a completely different situation mm-hmm. for your grapes. Can you tell me a little bit about the wines that you're showing in the market on this visit?
Well, two of the wines we're showing are our Mountain Estate Chardonnay and our Mountain Estate Cabernet. And here's an example of from the same property, the same estate, we can produce a really extraordinary Chardonnay at the same time as an extraordinary Cabernet. Mm. And that's because of the different locations of the actual vineyards themselves. The Chardonnay vineyard is on a 65-degree slope facing the north, and it's vertically as vertical plant rows, and it's at the 1,500 or 1,600-foot level. It gets early morning sun. We're above the fog line, and by noon, as the sun moves, it gets almost no direct sun on the vineyard in the afternoon, and that's perfect for mm-hmm. Chardonnay. But as the mountain, you come around the other side of the mountain, it faces south and southwest, gets very, very hot afternoon sun, and these are terraced, so they're about 20 feet apart and rocked in with big rock walls to hold it in, and that's where the Mountain Estate Cabernet comes from. So while they're on the same mountain, they get different exposures from the sun and really a whole different feeling from each of those vines right. during a day.
Was there much trial and error when you figured out where to put what vines?
Yes.
I mean, did you have to pull them out and
yes.
decide? Yeah. How long did that
so
take?
The joke is always, oh, you got in early. It must have been inexpensive. And I said, well, you're right. It didn't seem inexpensive when we were doing it the first time around, but because we needed to replant in some cases twice, learning about it, it's very expensive to replant, and so we have had to do that.
Well, it's a time investment too.
It is. It is.
And you have a Cab Franc in your lineup. How do people react to that?
Well, not many people. We only have 60 cases.
Oh,
okay. So what's it doing
so
there?
So not many people. We on our Mountain Estate, as on our Napa Valley Estate, we grow all five Bordeaux varietals, and we grow them in different blocks within the vineyard, depending on the actual the site itself. And Cabernet Franc is one of the five Bordeaux varietals, and we have a block of that. Which we usually use for blending purposes and usually just a little bit in each one.
Okay.
But the Cabernet Franc came about because one of the vintages they were tasting through Aaron Pott, who at the time was a consulting enologist with us, just said, stop, we have to bottle this Cabernet Franc on its own. And of course, our daughter, who's the winemaker, and son kept saying, we already have too many labels. We don't want to do this. And he just insisted that we hold three barrels out, and we did bottle it. And that was 6 years ago, and it sat unlabeled and everything in the cellar because we couldn't quite figure out what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Ellie has had a bottle. We'd mm-hmm. sent her a bottle. And we are now figuring out with those 60 cases what we're going to be doing with it.
I'll take one off your hand.
I think they should be special prizes for people who have you on their podcast.
Yes. I think so. That's a very
that would
good
be an
idea.
Excellent
that's,
nod.
That's a good start.
I put in my pitch.
Right.
Well, you were talking about all the different labels you have, and I know your children have started another one. I don't know if it's more directed to the millennials. I know it's more approachable price-wise, but it's called Unity, correct?
Exactly. It's the Unity of the first and second generation of Fisher. And we always talk about the unity that wine brings when you're having it with family and mm-hmm. friends, brings people together. But this was their opportunity to do some blending from different appellations, sub-appellations within the Napa Valley and now the Sonoma Valley, Sonoma appellation. It gave them, they originally wanted it because they wanted a Napa Valley Cabernet their friends could afford.
Yeah, right.
That was one of the impetuses. And it's grown now. We produce more Unity than we do our estate because our estate is limited. We're planted right out to the borderline of the property. Mm-hmm. And as I said, my husband and I started saying we weren't going to grow. We were just going to stay small and really take care of our vineyards. So now Unity is 10,000 cases. It's Unity Rosé, Unity Chardonnay, Unity Pinot Noir, and Unity Cabernet.
Now, are those in retail?
Not really.
Or
those
are
basically for Wine by the Glass programs.
Oh, okay.
And they've been extraordinary.
I've seen it at one place in Naples. But that was some time ago, mm-hmm. so I'm not sure if it's still there.
Let me ask you a question. Why is it that there are some wines that are only on restaurant wine lists and that winemakers don't want them to be available in retail?
I don't think it's you don't want them, but obviously, and we are in retail, but we're very selective. And we want to be in retail where you're not overwhelmed, where it's not just sitting on a shelf.
Among thousands of others.
And because we're small, nobody's ever heard of it. You want to have it introduced to their customers. And so we find very small retail stores that happen to have had a loyalty with our wines.
Right.
And can tell the story because I think the story, as much as the wine and how it tastes, is the story behind it. And
well, and the other risk when you have somebody that doesn't care about it as much as you do, it could find itself on a discount rack because
right.
they haven't told the story. They don't, you know, they haven't worked
or
with it.
Or maybe they haven't even tasted it.
Yeah.
You know, and in all of these cases, people have tasted our wines, been to the vineyards, and can tell the story and then, you know, introduce it to their customers.
Well, it's kind of like you're caring for something.
Right.
You're putting it out into the world. You don't want to, mm-hmm. you know, put it out into the world
right.
in the part of the world that you don't
right.
want it to be. So
exactly.
And it's your wine. So you yeah. can put it where you want.
yeah.
So let's wrap things up with a couple of rapid-fire questions.
Are you First
thing that comes to mind. Okay. Don't think. What's your favorite grape?
Merlot.
First time you fell in love. Oh, you want to ask? You
I love Merlot.
This is rapid fire. I don't know if you're going to follow.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm like, well, I'm just shocked. Merlot. Wow.
First time you fell in love with wine. Was it a bottle?
It was basically in Europe, and I wouldn't be able to tell you where, but we had some wonderful wines over there.
Yeah. That did it. Sealed the deal for you.
Okay. So what is your favorite kind of music?
Classical.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. I'm right there with you.
All right. Favorite thing to drink besides wine?
Champagne?
No. Disqualified.
Yeah. That's a wine because I would be right there with you. Like, is there a spirit or a...
Water, coffee?
I drink a lot of water, but I suppose every once in a while I love scotch. But very little because I'm getting older and I can't hold it as well.
Yeah, and it hurts, doesn't it? Yeah. But when you said Merlot for your favorite grape, I was really kind of surprised. Why do you like Merlot? Is it because it's easy to work with or just easy to drink?
It's not easy to work with
yeah?
as far as producing. But for Merlot, it's like, well, it's like a lot of things. I don't like bread unless it's absolutely extraordinary.
Mm, yeah.
And then I can't stop eating it. And it's the same way with Merlot for me. There's been a lot of, I think, just average Merlot. But when you get a Merlot that's incredibly good, I can't turn it away. I mean, it just, for me, it's easy, soft. It has all of the things that you're looking for in a fulfilling wine.
It's the kind of wine that is, you want to just cuddle with it, you know?
It's unctuous.
Right. It's like you just want to hang out. It's like a velvet blanket.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Were you impacted at all by any of the wildfires out there? You or your vineyards?
Yes, so I've been asked this question everywhere I go.
Well, because we heard so much
exactly.
about it.
Mm-hmm. And I will tell everybody, my first statement is, everybody in Northern California was affected, and nobody will forget about it. It was so horrendously awful. And so, yes, we were affected. It actually turned out that the Tubbs Lane fire started at the entrance to my sister's driveway.
Ooh.
And they drove out through with flames on both sides of the driveway and called and said, "We think we're losing our house." At which time I jumped in the car and started over, and they said, "Don't come because it's coming your way." And by the time I got to the Napa-Sonoma line, there was a total wall of red flames that was just terrifying. And I turned around, and 5 minutes later, when I turned into our driveway, it was like it had followed me. The winds were blowing the fire at 60 miles an hour, and it was like almost right at our driveway. And I just woke my husband up and said, "We have to leave," and grabbed the dog and left. And we were out of there for 12 days, not really knowing. And most people didn't really know. In the first two or three days, most people didn't know where it was going and what was going on. It was terrifying.
Did you, when you came back, your house was fine?
Our house was fine. The vineyards were fine. We had two vineyards, maybe 10% of our grapes that hadn't been picked, that were picked after the fire. But our daughter, who's the winemaker, and our son were able to go up and sneak past the blockades through other vineyards to get down to our winery to continue punching down the fermenting red wines and taking care of those. We needed to get a generator up there, which they took care of and had to take it through vineyards to get it mm-hmm. through because the road was blockaded with tanks and police.
Wow.
And they wouldn't let you in, even though we had to tend to the wine. But, yes, everything's fine. But, you know,
that was a stressful time. I'm
a
sure.
lot of people are still coming through this who lost their homes.
Mm. Yeah, that was
heartbreaking.
It really is. But I want to urge people to come because now the grass is green. And as a tourist and a visitor to the Napa Sonoma area, you won't see any of the fire damage. It's like nothing ever happened. It was the specific neighborhoods. Yes, if you went to those neighborhoods, they are flattened out like an atom bomb mm-hmm. had gone off. But those aren't where the tourists go. It was really in the hills above. And
yeah, I was there a couple of weeks ago, and
yes,
I didn't see anything.
Napa,
Yountville, nothing in those areas.
Right.
But then I went over to see my cousin in Vacaville, and I was trying to avoid that traffic on 12.
Yes.
Because it was backed up. And I'm like, I just have no patience for this.
Right, right.
So I took one of those windy roads to try to get over.
And then
I could see a little bit and smell just a little
bit. You can still smell, and when it actually rains is when you begin to get that ash smell, like like your fireplace when it's wet.
But you almost have to be looking for it to find it.
Yes,
a tourist.
So we really want, you know, the fire and all that happened afterwards really hurts the restaurants and the resorts there, the wineries. For about a month and a half afterwards, nobody came.
Yeah, every time there's national news about any kind of disaster like that,
the
hurricane here, you know, the hurricane.
Or... Exactly, and your people were hurting too.
Yeah.
But now the visitors are starting to come back, and we're open for business in every way, and we urge people to come and visit us.
Great. Right. Well, I'll be there.
Good.
I don't know when, but I'm looking at my calendar.
The door's open.
Thank you for coming in. It was so nice to see you and
great to
hear
be
your
with
story.
You. Yeah.
Appreciate it.
It was a great conversation.
You.
I really, really enjoyed it.
Perfect.
Great Minds is produced at WGCU Studios on FGCU campus in Fort Myers, Florida. Our producers for online media are Anna Bejarano and Tara Callaghan.
Technical production is by Mike Canary. Great Minds theme music is Frizzante by Colin Mannon.
To get in touch, check greatminds.org. Thanks for listening.